Welcome to WMKV Health Scope, a weekly discussion of health and wellness issues for older adults, their families, and caregivers. This call-in program is presented by 89.3 WMKV. To have your medical-related question concerning today's topic answered live on the air, call 513-772-9658. That's 772-WMKV. And now, WMKV Health Scope. We wish you a very good afternoon. We thank you for joining us here on WMKV and now on WLHS Public Radio as well for Health Scope. We have been doing a series of programs in the month of October that are very important. In October, as we come to the close of the month, we remind you that it is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and each year over 200,000 women are diagnosed with breast cancer. And thanks to dramatic improvements in cancer research, treatment, and early detection, millions of women are surviving breast cancer today. As such, we're focusing today's show once again on women's cancer survivors. Last week, we talked about early detection and actually the imaging of the breast. We're fortunate to have a healthcare expert with us today. In fact, we're culminating the month here with Dr. Lisa Larkin, the director of the UC Health Women's Center, to discuss cancer survivorship, menopause, and hormone therapy. We welcome Dr. Lisa Larkin. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here today.
Let's talk for just a moment about how you came to this area. It's a very, very important area. And I know sometimes I deal with all kinds of people who deal with people who have had family who has had cancer, cancer survivors, and they say this is one of the most difficult areas to be in. You make your living in this area. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you came to this field?
Well, so my background's a little bit different, I think, than anyone else that you've had on the show so far. So I am a internist who's been practicing in Cincinnati for the last 22 years already. And really, along that journey, have really developed an interest in midlife women's health and have really been caring for women at the menopause transition. And that's certainly a time where women are being diagnosed with breast cancer. And as you mentioned, this is an era where there's tremendous research and investment in early detection. And as a result, we've seen decreasing rates of mortality from early stage breast cancer. And so there's large numbers of breast cancer survivors who need to continue to have adequate medical care. I think the number is now upwards of 2.5 million breast cancer survivors nationally.
And I want to find out more about what is happening to these breast cancer survivors, what kind of challenges they face. It's very, very, a very important topic. And I think it also stresses that in many cases, early detection creates more survivors and learning more about what they're facing, having the regular test. If you suspect something, maybe you're doing a self-exam and you suspect that there's something there, it's best to talk about it with your physician immediately, not to scare people, but again, just to rule things out and make sure that it's not just a cyst or something like that. You definitely want to have that done. And we talk about this in the month of October. I'm sure you probably feel the way many other people do, that it's something we need to think about all year round, not just in October, but, you know, the pink ribbons are a great reminder and everything. But this is a very important time. Before we get into the challenges of survivorship, at what point should women really be checking themselves for any kind of lumps or things like that?
Right. So there's many published guidelines, and actually the difficult part for patients are that all of the guidelines don't really agree, and they've kind of changed over the years. But certainly I think first and foremost, all women should be aware of their breasts. They really should be thinking about breast health from a very early age, and that does not mean starting screening with mammography in your 20s or 30s, but certainly being aware of family history and what things that they can be doing to take care of their breasts. So one of the things that's really come out is that alcohol, for example, is a big risk factor for breast cancer. And so kind of, you know, there's many reasons to moderate alcohol, but certainly women should be paying attention to that. In terms of when to start screening, in 2009, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force came out with guidelines that kind of changed or at least led us to discuss what people have been doing. They changed guidelines to say women should start mammograms at 50 instead of age 40. But that's continued to be very controversial among large leading organizations. And I think most of us in practice are still encouraging mammography to begin at age 40 and to continue yearly. With that, U.S. Preventative Services Task Force guidelines also came out, some recommendations that really self-breast exams were not all that helpful. And you know, that's really something that I think that those of us that practice in the field really do encourage women to do. For those of us who take care of patients, we see women all the time coming in who have, in fact, found their own lumps, which require further evaluation because, as I'm sure was discussed last week, mammography is not a perfect test. And certainly, again, being aware of your body, women should be encouraged to pay attention to changes and that things that they feel on breast exam should be really evaluated.
And before we get, I promise we will get to breast cancer survivors and cancer survivors and the challenges. But one of the other things that I like to stress whenever we talk about this is also, does family history play a role in this? If you have a family history, is it something you should be checking maybe earlier than others or be more vigilant about?
So absolutely. So family history is one of the most important things that we really think about when, and, you know, women should be bringing to their physician's attention when they're seeing their physician if for some reason in these, you know, very pressured office visits, sometimes it's, you know, forgotten to be asked. But I will remind women that most breast cancers happen in women who have no family history still. So women, you know, I definitely have patients who will say, you know, I don't know how I got breast cancer. No one in my family has had breast cancer. And that really is because it's 70% of breast cancers really happen in women who have no family history. And I say to women, we're all at risk. We're all women. We all have breasts. We all are at risk of breast cancer. But family history certainly changes the risk very dramatically. Certainly if there's a first degree relative, so mother or sister with early stage breast cancer, or if there's a family history of multiple members of the family having breast cancer and or ovarian cancer that's thrown in there. And that is something that really should change how we're screening these patients and is something that's really important to be discussed with your physician.
Our very special guest, Dr. Lisa Larkin, the director of UC Health Women's Center. You can find out more at uchealth.com. Also, the phone number at 513-475-UC4U. And we'll give you the numbers, too, because some people don't like looking up all the stuff on the phone. 513-475-8248. And Dr. Larkin is our very special guest here today. We'll open up with the phone lines here on WMKV and WLHS and HealthScope in just a moment. But we'll be talking this hour also about hormone replacement therapy, what that can play into potential breast cancer, a sexual dysfunction in breast cancer survivors, and more. But I want to get back to one of the main areas, and Dr. Larkin is really here to talk to us about survivorship. And what are some of these challenges? I mean, obviously, this is a major, major hurdle. I can't overstate how important of a hurdle this is. I mean, it's a life-threatening illness, a life-threatening condition, and women are surviving it. More women than ever, is that true?
Correct. And that's, you know, again, we're detecting early, you know, breast cancer at an earlier stage. We definitely are curing more women from breast cancer. You know, we hate to use that term, but there are definitely, as I said, 2.5 million plus breast cancer survivors. And certainly as the internist and internist taking care of women who have survived breast cancer, really, women continue to go on focusing on their breast cancer and their risk of recurrent breast cancer, even often when they're 5 and 10 and 15 years out. And what happens is really that all of the other health issues that women are having often get missed because patients themselves are so focused on the fact that they're worried about their breast cancer returning, when in fact we really have to worry about other things such as cardiovascular risk and hypertension and thyroid disorders and the onset of type 2 diabetes. And really, so ongoing preventative general internal medicine care for patients who are breast cancer survivors is incredibly important. And many times the patients themselves are so focused on just worrying about breast cancer recurrence that a lot of the other potential issues get neglected or missed. And so that's part of the journey to becoming a cancer survivor, which is to remember to take care of all the other aspects of your health.
How do you approach this when you deal with a patient? That's a very important thing because I think if I had been battling cancer, that would be one of the first things. If I had beaten it or at least were either in remission or were excised, I would be so focused on that too. I think that's a very natural human reaction to say, this thing almost, you know, or threatened my life. This is what I'm worried about now. How is it education?
Right.
Is it counseling?
Well, I think
how
it's,
do you
it's do? A little bit of both. I mean, certainly, you know, breast cancer can be a fatal disease. So a woman who's diagnosed with breast cancer at age 42, for example, you know, the treatment itself has huge impact on her, be it surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, there's a big problem with chemotherapy-induced menopause and all of the consequences of that, that women who are diagnosed then with this with breast cancer really have so much reason to focus on the breast cancer diagnosis. But when that 42-year-old woman is now 52 and she's now 62, the problem is she still focuses on breast cancer often, that that's really what her problem continues to be, what she's most afraid of, when in fact, again, you really have to start to educate women and transition them to really paying attention to and thinking about all of the other health concerns that, you know, an average 62-year-old woman may have.
And I'm thrilled that you're talking about this, because I think for most of us who maybe have not personally battled any form of cancer, we can't really put ourselves in those people's places. But this is something that's very important. And I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it's also important for the family to be supportive of keeping that person, that patient, familiar with all the other things that they need to be on the lookout for. And sometimes the family may be the ones raising some of the red flags if the person is so focused on the cancer.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think what I also see sometimes is that, again, the patient really is just regular about seeing their oncologist or seeing the breast surgeon. They certainly are, you know, very fastidious about getting their mammography. But that internal medicine appointment, you know, having their labs done for cholesterol or blood sugar, making sure that they get their flu shot, that kind of falls by the wayside because, again, they're so worried about the breast cancer, which in most of these survivors really is never going to be a problem. Again, it's not breast cancer that they're going to die of. It's actually cardiovascular disease, which we know is the leading cause of death of women. So as the internist, not being the breast oncologist, not being the breast surgeon, I see the women who are survivors who are living 25 and 30 and 35 years beyond their disease who have very typical disorders of other older women, and it has nothing to do with the breast cancer.
And this kind of brings us full cycle, because earlier we were talking about mood disorders, which didn't have anything directly to do with breast cancer awareness. But last week we did talk about, the oncology side of this. It's great to have an internist here to talk about really making this, I don't want to say the term necessarily holistic in this case because it has other connotations, but it is important to look at the whole body, not just the areas that were affected by cancer. You mentioned a little bit earlier about induced menopause. How does this happen? My wife is like right on the cusp where we think she's going into natural menopause. But tell me what induced menopause is, and how does this work with cancer patients?
So the average age of menopause in the United States is 51, and there's a, you know, bell-shaped curve. So some women have natural menopause younger than that, and sometimes they're as old as 56, but in general, approximately age 51. When women are diagnosed with early stage breast cancer in their 40s, often part of the treatment regimen, very often, is chemotherapy, several cycles of chemotherapy, which, depending on the age of the woman, will often induce either at least a short-term hormonal menopause or will induce permanent early menopause, which has its own consequences. So again, a typical woman who does not have cancer, who's not been treated, average age is 51, many breast cancer patients will go through menopause earlier in their 40s. And this is a time when really women are not, it's not typical for them to go through menopause. So not only are they dealing with cancer, they're also dealing with the sequela of menopause on all the symptoms in terms of the hot flashes and the sweats and the sexual dysfunction that accompanies that.
So it's like this cascading effect. It's like, you know, you think maybe I'm out of the woods as far as the cancer goes, but now the treatment has actually brought on other changes in my body that are way premature.
Right. So I say to patients when they're diagnosed, you know, it's a tough journey that first year especially. Mm-hmm. So you have the surgery and the body image consequences of that, which are very difficult. You have chemotherapy, and the process of going through chemotherapy itself is very difficult. And then you have the consequences of the chemotherapy, which in many patients is an earlier induced menopause, and the consequences of that, which can include weight changes, mood disturbances. I don't know if it was mentioned with your previous speaker, but the peak times in a woman's life when they have mood disturbances is puberty, postpartum, and the menopause transition. And the common theme in those three times of life are big hormonal changes. And so, again, you have a woman who's 42 who's newly diagnosed with cancer who is going through all of, again, the surgery, the chemotherapy, the body image changes just dealing with having a cancer diagnosis. Now she's menopausal. She's having mood disturbances, sleep disturbances, hot flashes, sexual dysfunction, weight changes, all related to the menopause on top of everything else. And it's a really bumpy, difficult ride for women. And so part of the whole survivorship that I'm very interested in and take care of many women is really getting them through that first year and then going on to, again, feel well and live a long, productive, healthy, happy life.
Our very special guest, Dr. Lisa Larkin, here on HealthScope from the UC Health Women's Center. And our numbers are open at 513-772-9658 or toll-free 877-772-9658. Pam, we'll come to you in a moment, but I just want to play off of or ask a follow-up question to what Dr. Larkin just said. Just as we speak with people who work in, let's say, senior care, where sometimes the caregiver or the senior themselves feel like they're the only ones going through this, that they have a unique set of situations. And again, every person is unique. But dealing with places like the UC Women's Health Center, you have seen a lot of this. And it's good to have somebody that you can refer to that you can say, wow, maybe I'm not the only one who's gone through all of these changes. And to know that there's someone that you can discuss this with or that you can talk with, whether it's your own physician, whether it's the UC Women's Health Center, whether it's a specialist, but to actually be able to talk through this and find out that maybe you're not the only one exhibiting all of these different symptoms. That seems to me important, and it's the first thing, because I think when we have issues or we have problems, we tend to internalize them and we don't want to talk to anybody about it. And I think that's a big deal to have somebody that you can talk to about this.
Right. Well, I mean, certainly caring for breast cancer patients is a team-based approach and requires multiple physicians involved. But you're certainly correct that you need a whole scope of physicians to be involved because the issues are different and there's varying expertise of the varying physicians that are involved. But as you mentioned, really the support and feeling for women that they're not alone, I mean, that's one thing in Cincinnati. There's a tremendous network of young breast cancer survivor support groups, and certainly all of the Pink Ribbon events this month have been tremendous in terms of allowing women to feel that they are a connected community and that they really do have support among friends and family members. But one thing that I will mention that's my area that really is, again, kind of often neglected and that women are uncomfortable to talk about is the sexual dysfunction and the sexual consequences related to chemotherapy and early menopause. And again, because breast cancer survivor patients are a kind of a unique group in that there's controversy and debate about whether or not any hormones can be used in any circumstances, in any form. These women are kind of a group that treatment options are limited and more challenging and more controversial and difficult. And so women often believe that they're lucky to have survived their breast cancer, so they just have to live with the sexual dysfunction. They don't even bring it to the attention of their friends or their family members. They kind of suffer in silence. And so that's really been a very strong interest of mine because there certainly are It's important, I believe, that women have the opportunity to talk about that because, again, these women are living, if a woman at 40 lives to be 85, there's, really that's a huge quality of life issue and, an important aspect of her life if she's, not going to address sexual health for the subsequent 40 years. But again, the perception of patients is, A, they just have to kind of, live through it. They're lucky to have survived their breast cancer, and so the sexual dysfunction is not something that they even feel they should or can address.
It's okay to feel like you want a little bit more out of life than just surviving.
And you should be able to ask questions about what options are available to try to improve your quality of life. And it's the same thing, is around the menopause discussion with these patients as well.
We'll come back to the whole sexual dysfunction idea, as well as talking about hormone replacement therapy. But Pam has been waiting so patiently online. Pam from California. Pam, thank you for calling in at 772-9658. Well, actually, Pam called in at 877-772-9658. Pam, are you with us?
I sure am, and no, I didn't. I have flat rate, so I call through the regular line.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, though, for your time. Anyway,
I just want to pass on a couple of pick a couple of pieces of my own experience. I'll try to be brief. I had something that I didn't like on my breast, and I, for the doctor's benefit, I happen to be totally blind, and I'm not exactly smooth, so there's a lot of is it or isn't it when I'm touching. I can't go by color or anything like that. So anyway, I made an appointment, and I went to the doctor. I didn't tell my sweetheart because I didn't want to upset him, and she said, it's a pimple. Don't worry about it. Well, a couple of years later, I went, and I got a call back after the mammogram, and they said, there's a little shadow we want to look at. And I reached around, and I thought, oh, yeah, there is, isn't there? And it's something I had missed. Of course, I started watching it, and I made the appointment for the follow-up. They did the, I think it was a sonogram and another mammogram. Anyway, it took a couple of weeks, and as I'm examining, I notice this thing is starting to shrink. And sure enough, I went back, and I got the results, and it was a pimple. So I guess I'm bringing this up because it's it's good to have it checked out. You don't always know what you're feeling, if it is or it isn't a lump. And I just, by the time I went back, I knew the thing was shrinking, so I was able to say, yeah, it's. And the one doctor who last examined me said, we really weren't sure. We didn't think it was a lump, but we thought we'd better check it out.
And at no point, Pam, did it, nobody laughed at you and said, that's silly that you're asking this question, did they?
No. Well, it wasn't big enough that I right. even told anybody, at least. Well, actually, I did tell her about the second, and a friend of mine said, yeah, same thing happened to me. I've had several of these.
Right.
But no, nobody laughed. The one girlfriend that I did talk to, and I was frightened when I first noticed what they were telling me about. No, nobody laughed. And
good,
when I
good.
Talked to this friend of mine, she did tell me, and sure enough, later on, it was I was okay, and I am about to call my doctor for the results of the mammogram that I just had last week.
Well, I'm glad it turned out okay for you, and that's mm-hmm. great that you had it checked out.
Pam,
great.
Thank you so much for the comments.
Sure, take care.
Thank you. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. 772-9658 or 877-772-9658. And again, when in doubt, best to check. Is that correct?
I
mean, always
absolutely.
Err on the side of caution when we're dealing with this, because again, it comes back to what we were talking about with early detection. Our special guest, Dr. Lisa Larkin from the UC Health Women's Center. You can find out more at uchealth.com or at 513-475-UC4U. That's number-wise, 8248. So 475-8248. Now, we have a few minutes before we go to our break here, and we were talking about induced menopause that can happen from some of the treatments. And are there other treatment options for menopause different in or what are those treatment options? I know a lot of times there are ways to kind of ease the strain of menopause for women. But you said that sometimes this is fairly controversial because women who are cancer survivors have to maybe watch what hormones they're using and things like that. Maybe I'm putting the cart a little bit before the horse because we'll talk about hormone replacement therapy along the way. But how are the treatments different for a cancer survivor who may have an early induced menopause or a natural menopause state?
Right. So younger women who have chemotherapy-induced menopause often have the most severe symptoms. So what we know is that women who transition more gradually through menopause at the typical age of 51 may have mild to no symptoms, actually, and really menopause may not be all that big a deal in terms of their symptoms. Women who have younger abrupt menopause, so the chemotherapy basically takes the ovaries out, you know, so the ovaries really are producing little to no hormones. So that change in where a young woman's estrogen levels were pre-chemotherapy to post is very dramatically different. And we know that surgically induced menopause, so if a woman needs to have her ovaries removed for some reason, or chemotherapy induced menopause, symptoms tend to be the most severe. So again, you're dealing with a woman who has a new diagnosis that's very difficult, and the body image changes and the chemotherapy and now very severe menopause, really these are women who really come in seeking help. Now, breast cancer survivors, I think there's controversy, or we could discuss for a long time, a couple different aspects. A, whether or not hormone therapy in healthy women causes or does not cause breast cancer, and that's a whole different discussion. And I think the separate discussion would be breast cancer survivors and treatment of sexual dysfunction with local estrogen, meaning just vaginal estrogen. But I think all of us would really agree that hormone therapy, systemic hormone therapy, meaning pills, gels, patches, rings, to treat chemotherapy-induced menopause in a breast cancer patient would not be indicated. So this is really, you know, a cause of concern. We don't want to give hormones to women who are newly diagnosed with breast cancer. And these women are often on other medications, Arimidex, tamoxifen, where really, again, we want to suppress their estrogen levels. We want them to have low estrogen. We want them to be on anti-estrogen medication. So hormones are contraindicated. So we have to shift gears completely.
Yes. What are the
and
options?
And use non-hormonal medications. Okay. And there's a whole host of things that we use. Actually, there's just a new medication that was FDA approved within the last several months, something called Brizdel, which is actually a low-dose form of paroxetine, which is Paxil, which has been shown to be effective, which would be one option for patients. But all of the antidepressants can show benefit in terms of decreasing the frequency and severity of hot flashes. So things like Prozac or venlafaxine, Effexor is the trade name, can certainly be used. Other things include gabapentin or clonidine. So these are other non-hormonal medications. And really, we use them very liberally to try to help women who are suffering.
I could see maybe a woman out there who may be in this situation saying, well, geez, Prozac, you know, I don't want to be on this long term. Is the Prozac generally something that they would be on long term or just through this particular phase?
Well, we really try to help women transition. So when their symptoms are most severe, we're really using it. I will tell you, typically it's 1 to 2 years often if it's very abrupt menopause that women are symptomatic. So there is a period of time. But again, we're using it. It may help with mood disturbance if there is mood disturbance related to the menopause transition, but certainly for the hot flashes is what we're using it for, and for sleep.
And we have Dr. Lisa Larkin here with us here on WMKV and WLHS 89.3 and 89.9 and around the world at WMKVFM.org. She is the director of the UC Health Women's Center. You can find out a lot more at uchealth.com or at 513-475-8248. If you want to join Pam from California, who called us, Pam's one of our regular callers. We love Pam. And she listens to us all the time in California. And it's so funny when we have new guests in here and somebody calls from California, the eyebrows raise and all that. But we have people listening all over the place. So if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 513-772-9658 or toll free 877-772-9658. And I'm also here to say that the UC Health, the whole area of UC Health at uchealth.com is really something that is nationally recognized. So you're hearing from good people here when they come on HealthScope here with us. We're going to take a quick break. If you'd like to join us, again, it's 513-772-9658 or 877-772-9658. Back in a moment with more of HealthScope. The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program or of WMKV Radio, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or its staff and management. Discussion of specific points and general topics on this program are not meant to be taken as specific professional advice. And we're back here on WMKV and WLHS. The program is HealthScope. Today we're talking a third in a series of programs on women's health issues. But of course, this being October and National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, at least as we're recording the show, these shows will repeat throughout the year. And it shouldn't just be sequestered to October anyway. But we have Dr. Lisa Larkin here, the director of UC Health Women's Center. And she is here discussing cancer survivorship and some very interesting things. We spent a little bit of time talking about early induced menopause that often happens or can happen with chemotherapy and other cancer treatments. But I want to come back, and like I said, I think I was putting the cart before the horse a little bit, because last week on this program, we were talking about the whole role that at least suspected, if not proven, I don't know if it's proven or suspected or whether it's being researched, we hear about something called hormone replacement therapy, especially for women who basically this is something that's meant to help. But we are now suspecting, I guess, to some extent, that maybe it's involved with development of breast cancer. We have Dr. Lisa Larkin here with us, who is not just somebody with the UC Health Women's Center, but also an internist. What is your take on hormone replacement therapy? And first of all, can you tell us what it is and how it might come into play here?
So let me start by saying this is something that I do, you know, in practice day in and day out. And, you know, there is a tremendous amount out there in the media, both print, radio, and on the internet for information about menopause management and hormone therapy. And not 100% all of it is accurate. I would really encourage any of the listeners who are interested in getting information about menopause to go to menopause.org, which is the North American Menopause Society's website, which is really the leading organization nationally to provide evidence-based information to women about menopause. But let me talk about hormone therapy.
Yes.
And we call it hormone therapy now, HT, not hormone replacement therapy.
I'm sorry.
No, no,
yes.
No, it's okay. it's still used all the time. But just to kind of clarify that really, you know, menopause is a natural transition in a woman's life. What's different these days is that women are living 30-plus years beyond menopause. And so women are spending a third plus of their life postmenopausal. And this is really something that we need to think about and address. The menopause transition itself, as I mentioned earlier, in about 30% of women can be really mild and not a really significant event with a lot of symptoms. But in the women that I see in practice, and for many women, it's a time where they feel terrible. They're having hot flashes and night sweats and insomnia and weight gain and mood disturbance and often palpitations and dry skin and sexual changes. And the question comes up, you know, can we use hormone therapy to help these women? We know that hormone therapy is, in fact, the most effective treatment for these symptoms. Where the controversy has really come is from the Women's Health Initiative, which was a large randomized placebo-controlled study that the data was released in 2002. So it's old by research study standards now, but it changed the universe in terms of the way that we thought about hormones. Prior to 2002, we really believed that hormones were good for every woman, really. And in the years that I was practicing prior to the WHI, certainly the vast majority of my patients were on hormone therapy for the vast majority of their post menopausal life, because at the time the data suggested that we were preventing heart disease in these women and that we were doing much more benefit than harm. The Women's Health Initiative data came out in 2002, and the news media splashed all over the place that there was a 25% increased risk of breast cancer and a 25% increase in heart disease and a 30% increase in stroke, and women stopped their hormone therapy immediately. Without talking to their physicians, they threw it in the toilet, and all of these women then had recurrent symptoms. And what we have learned now from 2002 to now, where we are 11 years later, is really that it's much more complicated than that. What we have learned is that younger women close to the menopause, so we're talking 50, 51, 52, women who are very symptomatic, really can use short-term hormone therapy with very little risk and with substantial benefit in terms of improvement of symptoms, quality of life, and there does appear to be data about decreasing cardiovascular risk as well, not increasing. What we do know, and where this is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, though, is that there appears to be an increase in breast cancer risk with longer duration of use. And it appears that there's some issue with certain types of hormones that we give women. But it's not a one-size-fits-all. So it appears that really with under 5 years years of use, with lower doses and using them in women closer to the menopause for a shorter period of time, that there's really preferential safety benefit compared to the risk. And so women really who are very symptomatic at menopause don't need to be as fearful about hormones as they were. We certainly individualize care.
Yes.
Women with a family history, women with a past history of breast cancer, they are not appropriate hormone candidates, but there certainly are many women there who really hormone therapy short-term is appropriate.
And one of the things I would imagine, again, I'm kind of reading into this, but that you probably don't want to do is just see some report online somewhere on the internet, which the internet's a great thing, but it can also not always give you the full picture. Don't just cease using something, no matter what the medication, if it's been prescribed to you or if it's something that you and your doctor have agreed is beneficial, just because you read something online, the first step is to talk to your physician about those concerns.
Right. I will say that, you know, the news media really did put out a lot of, you know, very scary information.
Sure. Headline sell.
Right.
That's what it's
right.
all about.
And so, yeah. And physicians, frankly, were very confused by the data as well. And I will, you know, give an example, which is the news media, when it reported that there was a 25% increased risk of breast cancer, when you talk to individual patients, what they took that data to mean is that they have a 1 in 4 chance of developing breast cancer if they were taking hormones, which was high. When you really look at it, though, and I use this when I'm talking to women in practice all the time, based on the data now, what we know, if I have 100 women in practice and I follow them from age 50 to 60 and none of them are on hormones, 3 women will develop breast cancer. If I have a different 100 patients and I follow them from 50 to 60 and I have them on the hormone replacement therapy that was used in the trial, which we think is relatively high dose now compared to what we're using, and I follow them for 10 years, 4 women will develop breast cancer.
So it's only a difference of one.
One breast cancer in 1,000 patient years, which is real and it's measurable and it's something that we need to talk to patients about. But it is certainly not a 1 in 4 chance that the hormones are causing the breast cancer. What I tell women is we all are at risk of breast cancer because we're women, and that the added increment of increased risk that hormone therapy gives is relatively small. What women don't realize is that there's at least just as much risk of increasing your breast cancer risk with daily alcohol consumption as there is with the low-dose hormone replacement therapy. And so you have to put it into perspective for patients, because a woman who's miserable, suffering through menopause, and is fearful of breast cancer really needs to understand that that risk is really very small and they may get tremendous benefit from the hormone therapy.
While we're at it, what are some of the other risk factors? What are some of the other things that women should be aware of? You mentioned alcohol is one of them. Are there some other tips that you would give to women to avoid becoming more at risk for developing breast cancer?
Right. So the key things really are, as they are for many things, diet,
yes,
maintaining ideal body weight, exercise. And so there's clear data that a diet high in fruits and vegetables, leafy greens, and maintaining ideal body weight has impact on prevention of breast cancer. And actually, there's even studies that suggest that women do better with treatment, have longer survival, lower relapse rates, again, if they're consuming a diet high in fruits and vegetables, in relatively low fat, maintaining ideal body weight and exercising. And the big thing with alcohol now, years ago, I used to say that we thought that it was one drink a day was really okay, that 7 drinks per week was really the limit. We now really know that it's actually much lower than that, that really the number is about 3 drinks per week. And patients always ask me, well, what about the benefit of red wine for heart? And what we know is that you really only need about a half glass of red wine a day to get the benefit in terms of heart disease risk reduction. And really, that's about 3 drinks per week. So really, less is more when it comes to alcohol. And exercising more is good for everything.
Dr. Lisa Larkin is our special guest. She is the director of UC Health Women's Center. More details at uchealth.com or at 513-475-8248. We're here on WMKV and WLHS HealthScope. We have Dr. Larkin here with us for a few more minutes, and you can join the conversation if you have a question at 772-9658 or toll-free 877-772-9658. We've talked about a little bit more about hormone therapy here. I wanted to get back to one of the other questions that came in before the program, which is, what advice do you typically give to women cancer survivors who are going through menopause? I mean, we've talked about many different angles of this, but really, is there some set advice that you would give?
So absolutely. First and foremost, we really look at lifestyle changes to help with menopausal symptoms, and certainly they do help. So layered clothing, keeping the room at a cooler temperature, avoiding very stressful activities. We see, you know, stressful situations can bring hot flashes on in women very dramatically. And again, we're back to alcohol. Certainly, we know that drinking alcohol increases the frequency and severity of hot flashes. And so, you know, women who are really symptomatic, again, you know, new breast cancer diagnosis, they should really be drinking, you know, as little alcohol as they possibly can. And then we really talk, you know, as I mentioned, all about the non-hormonal options if they're still really struggling. And many women really do struggle during this time, we look at all of the non-hormonal options to help them.
And I guess there was another question that was on the wonderful list that we had here, which was, what's important for all women to know about menopause that few actually do know? Now, we've covered a few things, I think, but are there some other things that maybe women or even their families may not understand or know about menopause?
So I think one of the things is that women often, again, are symptomatic. So the outward, you know, changes and you know, there's many cartoons about the itchy, bitchy, moody, bloated, you know, all of the different varying side effects, which women really feel. And again, often women really do not feel well during this time. But what I think is less well known is that this is also the time where, because of the abrupt hormonal changes, we often see big changes in things that women don't feel, meaning elevations in blood pressure. There's often a huge change in lipids. So women who prior to menopause have normal cholesterol and high HDL and relatively low LDL, postmenopausally, their lipids totally look different.
Wow.
And the incidence of diabetes goes up very abruptly. So there's
hormones
have something to do with, a lot to do with insulin resistance and blood sugar control. And so postmenopausal women have a much higher chance of having now borderline sugars and early pre-diabetes. And so this is a time where I really do, you know, tell patients that if you have been using your OBGYN as your primary care provider, you know, through this time, really at 50, again, not just, you know, because of the menopause things, but because of all of the other things that start to develop, it's really time to make sure you have an internist as part of your healthcare team. Because, again, those are things that you would not necessarily know are changing.
Exactly. And I have to ask about the whole diabetes, because I know that women who are in pregnancy can often go into a form of diabetes. I took it that that was partially a hormonal change, but also the extra weight of the baby and everything. Is the diabetic condition sometimes with menopause, is it temporary? Does it become a long-term chronic?
So I say that there are very few things in our life that are very black and white, certainly in healthcare. And one of them is, you know, you're pregnant or you're not pregnant. That's
black
or white. But with diabetes, it's really a spectrum disorder, meaning that you have normal blood sugar metabolism, and you know, when you're 20 and you're not diabetic, your body does a great job of producing just enough insulin and keeping your blood sugar within a very narrow range, regardless of what you eat. As you get older, we lose the ability to regulate everything, but blood sugar in particular, very, very well. And certainly, you know, the abrupt change in hormones at menopause makes that a problem. So suddenly we start to see these borderline blood sugars, and generally over time that tends to get worse. What women need to do, and again, it goes back to healthy lifestyle, it's maintaining ideal body weight and exercising regularly. Those things have huge impact on maintaining blood sugars and preventing this insulin resistance. But in general, it's not just a transitional thing, which is, it's really something that if a woman's starting to have blood sugar issues, borderline blood sugars in the menopause transition, they need to pay attention to that, because without paying attention to it, typically that will go on over time to be overt type 2 diabetes. And one thing just about the pregnancy, I should mention that, you know, if a woman has gestational diabetes, she has over a 50% chance of developing type 2 diabetes in her lifetime. And that is really something that, again, history is very important, because we screen much more carefully for women that have a history of gestational diabetes.
So if at any point you have those elevated blood sugar levels, it's always good to kind of keep an eye on that and have regular checks with your family doctor. We have Dr. Lisa Larkin here with us, and we're talking largely about Breast Cancer Awareness Month here in the month of October. This may be repeating at other times of the year. This is a very important topic for us to talk about as well. And she's actually the director of the UC Health Women's Center. And we are talking largely on today's show about cancer survivorship. And you mentioned a little bit earlier on that women after cancer, after they are cancer free or either in remission or actually have the cancer removed, have lived decades. They are survivors. But one of the points that you brought out earlier in the program is that you have to go beyond sometimes the, boy, I'm just lucky to be alive phase, especially when you still have maybe 3-4 decades to go in your life, even if it's one decade. The point is that you have a long period of time, And quality of life in that period of time is very important. And one of the things that I know you've been a champion of discussing and trying to bring out into the open is the whole discussion of sexual dysfunction in breast cancer survivors. How does this come into play? Are most women just happy to just be alive, and they're secretly unhappy and internalizing this, with which creates other health issues, could create higher blood pressure, can create other things. But how does sexual dysfunction in breast cancer survivors come into play here?
Well, I should say that this area of interest and focus in my practice really developed out of the needs of my patients. It was not something I woke up in one morning and said, sure, this is what I'm interested in. It was because really in caring for patients with breast cancer who are survivors, either immediate survivors, relatively close to diagnosis, or long-term survivors, it became clear that this is an area that women do not talk to their physicians about very often. And physicians, many of them, don't ask. And so women, again, are really focused, thankful that they're breast cancer survivors, and don't really bring this up. When you actually get them, women, talking about it, you realize what an impact this is having on their quality of life, their relationships, their self-esteem, and that just like any other aspect of their life, if this is, and this is an important piece of their life, we should be addressing this, because quality of life is certainly, for all of us, I think we would say, as important as quantity of life, that really women who are living a long time deserve to have, you know, a good quality sexual health as well. And they can't have that if they're having problems and they're not discussing it with their physician. The good news is that there's lots of treatment options available, and the in my clinical experience really is that many times very simple things can help a woman, and they just haven't even tried them. They haven't been offered. They're just not knowledgeable about this because they've never brought it to anyone's attention. And certainly there's just – it's been a very rewarding aspect of my career, because I've helped women who really were suffering in silence for a long period of time.
I was going to say for young or for older generations, for generations that are now maybe into their 60s, 70s, 80s, it just wasn't anything you ever talked about. It was almost taboo to talk about it with anybody, even with your physician, even in that very intimate relationship. And I know sometimes with physicians, you may only feel like you have a few minutes with that physician. And so it falls farther down the priority list, I guess, if you have other questions. But one of the first things that you can do is, if you are experiencing, what are some of the things that women would be experiencing that would be red flags that they should talk to their physician about?
So the most common thing is vaginal discomfort, irritation, burning, dryness, which mm-hmm. makes sexual relations very uncomfortable and painful. And certainly, you know, if something is painful and uncomfortable, it's not something you're very interested in doing, and it becomes this very often circular experience for women, which is that, you know, they're miserable and suffering. It hurts. They don't want to do it. It, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and it becomes
and it
an issue in their relationships.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And for that aspect, there really often are very simple, easy things that
without
we can
hormone,
do.
Without hormones.
We certainly start with all kinds of things that we have available that are not hormonal. And then again, depending on the patient, depending on the patient's oncologist, depending on lots of factors, certainly in many patients who are breast cancer survivors, it is reasonable and available to use vaginal estrogen locally, which is a very different animal than what we were talking about with systemic hormone therapy. So a year of vaginal estrogen is equivalent to one birth control pill in terms of the amount of estrogen that we're giving anyone. So, I mean, you can just see it's absolutely totally different numbers in terms of what we're exposing a woman to. And again, depending on the severity, and only if they've not responded to non-hormonal measures, but certainly, you know, in some patients, it's a reasonable thing to do.
Is there still, and again, I'm a man, I understand that men can get breast cancer, but it is far less likely for men to get breast cancer. For women who have lost part of their breast, is that another part of the, if you, maybe more body image than sexual dysfunction, but how do women, are they better today? Are there more resources for women to deal with that issue if that was an important part of their body to them?
So absolutely. I mean, there's no question that in women, even more than men, the largest sex organ is actually the brain, right? Mm-hmm. So if mm-hmm. you have body image issues, that really does affect a woman's interest in sexual activity. And really, again, it's women are very complicated when it comes to sexual health. There's a lot of things that interrelate. And so it typically isn't just one thing that needs some discussion or to be addressed. But the body image part is huge for women who have really undergone, you know, really disfiguring surgery often. The good news is the reconstruction and the surgical reconstruction for women with breast cancer now has come an amazing way, and the reconstructions now are often fabulous. And so that helps women. That's one of the big pushes to do reconstruction immediately at the time of diagnosis and their initial surgery now, as opposed to waiting, just again, so that women don't have to go through that body, as much of that body image change.
And do you feel that for the families of the survivors or the spouses, if you will, or the loved ones of the survivors, are they understanding more and more about what's going on from, I mean, you have to deal with the patient, but I would imagine that they would eventually share with you, boy, you know, my family just doesn't get it.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, relationships and good communication are the key to many things in life, and certainly in the arena of any new cancer diagnosis, but certainly in terms of cancer survivorship, and especially in the arena of sexual health, you know, communication is critical to, you know, making anything move forward and be better.
Here, here. We have Dr. Lisa Larkin here with us, the director of the UC Health Women's Center. 513-475-8248 is their number, or uchealth.com. In the final couple of minutes, I try to ask a lot of our physicians who are in here, this is just not really much of a curveball, but what do we know about cancer survivorship now that we didn't know maybe 10 years ago? And where would you like to see research into either cancer survivorship or treatments going in the future?
So I think there's a huge initiative now to focus more on survivorship. There's a saying now that survivorship starts at diagnosis. And so there's a real push now to start to get patients thinking about survivorship at diagnosis and for really looking at living with the diagnosis and through the treatment, as opposed to just focusing on the cancer treatment. I think it's a big paradigm shift. And certainly in the arena of training of physicians and nurses, there's much more of an emphasis now in oncology about focusing on specific survivorship programs and survivorship training. So again, we can bring to the forefront things that patients can be doing to survive, to stay healthy, to move forward, to live with their diagnosis. And that really is a big change, really, in the last 10 years. In terms of what we're learning in terms of the whole research aspect, it really is kind of the long-term consequences of chemotherapy is certainly one very specific area of research. My personal interest, again, is in menopause and hormone management of female cancer survivors and in the arena of sexual dysfunction and sexual health in cancer survivors. And there's a tremendous amount of research going on now in kind of newer non-hormonal options for women who are specifically breast, but breast, ovarian, cancer survivors for treatment of the vaginal dryness and the vaginal symptoms related to menopause in those patients.
Well, one of the best things that I can say is that education is the other part of it, and shedding some light on it, getting people more comfortable to talk about it with their physicians or with their families. That it, just as Pam said, you know, she had as a great point was, you know, I was afraid and I didn't want to tell anybody about it, but at least she went to her doctor and talked about it. You got to take care of it if you sense something there. It's so important. And early detection, we come back to that every time. But Dr. Lisa Larkin, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
You've been a font of information.
Wonderful
internist. She is the director of the UC Health Women's Center. Again, 513-475-8248 or uchealth.com. I'm George Zahn for WMKV and WLHS. You've been listening to HealthScope.
You've been listening to WMKV Health Scope. Join us again next Monday at 1 p.m. for another edition of WMKV Health Scope on 89.3 WMKV Reading, Ohio.